From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma.
I'm from Berkeley.
Concord, Cali.
Tenderloin District.
La Mission.
The Mission District.
Noe Valley.
I live in Silver Terrace.
Coming up, we'll look at the bond between a former foster kid and a very special volunteer.
No matter how dark, no matter how deep, and sometimes no matter how silly it got, she always listened.
Then we meet a journalist who wants to change how the media reports on the foster care system.
The news media likes to cover the 1% story, which is the worst case scenario, so the child death.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. Come along for the ride. It's Cross Currents. Over 400 million kids are in the U.S. foster system today. In California alone, there are 60,000 in care. For many, change is the only constant. Living in different homes with different people, switching schools. Many become homeless after they exit the system as young adults. SF CASA, or San Francisco Court-Appointed Special Advocates, is a nonprofit in the Mission District whose aim is to help these vulnerable youth. Founded in 1991, it's a part of a national network of independent organizations, and CASAs are volunteers who work one-on-one with a kid in foster care. They're sworn in as officers of the San Francisco Juvenile Dependency Court. While a foster kid may have several adults working on their case, caregivers, social workers, lawyers, a CASA is there to thread together the details. They try to provide some stability for children growing up in the middle of this complicated system. KALW's Truk Nguyen brings us the story of one former foster youth and his CASA.
Former foster youth Nick Sullivan moved into his 580-square-foot apartment a little over a year ago.
Obviously, you're in the living room right now, my couch and my TV, my PlayStation 4.
He says it's the first place that's felt like home since he entered the system at age 6.
And then from the door, there's a little hallway to where you used to see the kitchen and the dining room.
When did you get this TV?
Around Christmas time. They were having a sale after Black Friday, and I got this one for like $230.
Chris Unruh is visiting today. She's Nick's court-appointed special advocate, or CASA. She opens the refrigerator and peers in.
Well, there's healthy stuff. Carrots, good for you, Nick.
Salad.
I see the salad stuff.
And then I've got cilantro because I made some tacos and pico de gallo the other day.
Nick's freezer is equally well stocked with waffles, pizza rolls, and frozen turkey and chicken. Chris is impressed, but not surprised.
He's quite a cook. He's always coming up with new recipes.
Yeah.
Chris looks around the one-bedroom apartment and smiles. Nick clears a spot for her to sit on a couch he got on Craigslist. When they met in 2010, Nick was 15 and living at the St. Vincent Group Home for Boys in Marin. He was being bullied, getting into fights, but he was also getting pretty good at horseback riding, which the group home offered as a therapeutic activity. One day, sweaty and dirty after a session, he went to the stables to meet his new CASA.
It was pretty awkward. I knew someone was coming, no idea who this person was. All I heard was Chris. I didn't hear Christine, so naturally I thought it was a guy. And next thing I know, this sweet, you know, lady who's, no offense, but older than me, is walking towards me. I'm like, oh, so that's her.
Although it was awkward, Chris had the inside scoop from his therapist. She had been a CASA before and knew it was important to do her homework. Nick had one main obsession, so she asked him, seen any good movies lately?
And when she brought that up, I kind of had this feeling like, okay, now we're getting somewhere.
They went to a lot of movies to get to know each other. Horror and action movies, like Rambo and Nightmare on Elm Street, were some of his childhood favorites. Not exactly Chris's usual picks.
Some of the movies, he's right, were not movies that I would have chosen on my own. I can't say I didn't enjoy them, but I wouldn't have gone there if it had been my choice.
Chris says building a friendship with Nick was key. It was the only way the two could work together to get things done, like staying on top of social workers or making sure Nick graduated from high school.
I don't think people know anything about foster youth. I mean, Nick was sort of lucky, if you want to call it that, because he didn't have to change schools too many times. He did, but some foster youth go to, you know, two or three or four different schools in one school year. You know, the total impermanency of their lives, I don't think anybody really understands that.
She says foster kids sometimes ask their CASAs how much they get paid. When Nick learned this wasn't Chris's job, that she was freely giving her time, that was big.
Kids like us who never had anyone who just wanted to be there for you because they wanted to help you, it changes our view and our perspective on things. And it makes us change how we feel about opening up about things that we've been through.
It's a transition, getting to know a new person, Nick says. Takes time. Chris visited about once a week over several years, and their relationship kept growing stronger.
Like, I've told Chris some really damaging stuff that happened to me. You know, stuff that would give a shrink PTSD almost sometimes, but it's just, you know, she still listened, no matter how dark, no matter how deep, and sometimes no matter how silly it got. She always listened.
Chris says she herself didn't have a mentor growing up.
So I'm glad that I could provide some help to somebody else.
What do you mean some? You've helped me loads. It's true. I mean, CASA, not just CASA, not really. I won't even really even say CASA because I feel Chris is the one who, working through CASA, but Chris was the one who helped me and helped me improve my life, but also helped me be the kind of person that I am today with her constant persistence on getting things done. Awkward sigh there, but true. It helped, you know, as annoying as it was at times, it helped.
So proud of Nick. No, really, I really am. He's come a long, long, long way.
A big part of Akasa's job is making sure kids receive safe housing. In Nick's case, he spent half his life in a group home. But a year and a half ago, Chris helped him get his own apartment through a supportive housing nonprofit.
I'm really glad for him. He almost always had a roommate in a very small place. And I know that's not unusual for people, but you know, it's always nice to have your own space, and I'm glad that he has it.
Nick says as happy as he was to move into his own place for the first time, it felt foreign.
Growing up with roommates for so long, I remember for the first, like, 6 months that I lived here, it was actually really lonely because I was so used to having someone there all the time in my room with me that now I have this entire, you know, I think it's 580 square feet all to myself.
But he says he's gotten used to it.
It's just like I wake up, I brush my teeth, I do everything normally. It just feels normal, honestly. And honestly, for someone who grew up the way I did, asking, you know, just being able to live a normal life is really all we want.
Since Nick aged out of foster care, Chris isn't his CASA anymore. But after 7 years, they're like family. The two still go out to lunch and catch up about once a month. Nick says now that he's on his own feet, he feels like he's finally able to begin life. He's now working and saving up to go to film school. In San Francisco, I'm Truk Nguyen for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next guest knows a lot about the foster care system. Journalist Daniel Heimpel is the founder of Fostering Media Connections, a nonprofit he started in 2010. He focuses on the foster system through what he calls solutions-based reporting. He got the idea after noticing that a lot of reporting on foster kids tends to focus on how hard life is for these kids rather than on ways to help. Daniel Heimpel is a lecturer at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. He came in to talk about the intersection of journalism, child welfare, and policy.
Generally speaking, the news media likes to cover the 1% story, which is the worst-case scenario, so the child death and these horrible circumstances that which are really not representative of the lives of these kids or the way the system functions.
You were talking about kind of this one narrative, like the doomsday narrative, in regards to foster youth, how hard their lives are. What are the dangers of this narrative? What can that lead to, and what are we ignoring when we tell stories this way?
I don't want to say that there's just a completely myopic view of the system. I just know that the stories that get the big attention are the ones about child deaths. The ones that win the big prizes are about the child deaths. And what I think is the most dangerous thing about that is that you can, I mean, on many levels, I think you start reacting. So if I'm a child welfare system and I get a child death, your reaction is then to start removing children at a higher rate. So now you're starting to rip families apart at a higher rate to try to assuage the public narrative that has pointed out that you let a kid die.
That's powerful then.
That's powerful, yeah.
Our work is powerful.
It's extremely powerful. I mean, in Los Angeles,
it creates that kind of change on the ground.
Oh, right away. Moreover, when we start calling social workers inept and everything else, what you see is that they're also some of the lowest paid workers and least valued, and they're doing some of the most valuable work. So I think there's a whole line of things that we end up looking at the worst and relegating the entire system to a low place on the totem pole of societal value, and that's just totally wrong.
Mm. How has fostering media connections impacted public policy? What changes are you seeing through your work?
A good example in California has been following the passage of Assembly Bill 12, which extended foster care to age 21, mm-hmm. which we were very active in covering and making the linkage between the federal policy and the state policy and the local policy, which helped drive that law forward. And then afterwards, finding out when gaps created by the cheapness of lawmakers were infringing upon the benefits that young people should have been receiving. And we focused on those in several iterations.
And what's the impact of that on a John or a Maria?
Just quick example. So when they passed AB 12 to extend foster care to age 21, it gets implemented in January of 2012. I'm 18 in 2012, but I also turned 19 in 2012. If I remember correctly, 2,188 kids who were eligible for AB 12 in 2012 on their 18th birthday, but would turn 19 during that same year, which means they were on a bubble and they were excluded from those benefits when they turned 19. So you're getting benefits, and then when you turn 19,
all of a sudden you're cut off.
You're cut off. So, you know, we started covering that. Some local media outlets started to pick up on it, and eventually the Department of Finance had to come out and say, okay, we're going to pay for all of these bubble kids. So that cleared it up, cleared the path for a kid who was turning 19 that year to be able to get those extended foster care benefits.
What are you working on right now?
We're looking a lot at, right now, the state of California will be, is engaging in a massive shift away from the use of group homes.
To what?
To what, you know, to foster care. But it's been reformulated as resource parents. So the idea is to stack resources with strangers giving foster care or kin giving foster care. So that kids aren't spending so much time in group homes. In that process, there's a lot of accountability that reporting, and that's something all reporters should be looking at, and a lot of people will be looking at because it's a huge reform, is to what degree are these resource families existent? We have a real dearth of foster families in this state. So the assumption that we're going to be able to place these kids in other places after taking them out of a group home requires that we find these families to take them. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that do exist, we have to do a very good job of retaining those. We're going to be bird dogging that implementation, as we did with AB 12, to find gaps, cover those gaps, and hopefully in so doing, have those gaps filled.
Why are you doing this work?
Why?
Yeah. What is it for you?
It's a lot of things. I mean, I'm very interested in the way we try to make up for our social inequities. And here you can see it. It's the grinding edge of all of our social problems. So understanding it and seeing it is a lens through which you can see really broad systemic issues.
What can just the citizen do who is not a journalist, a muckraking journalist?
So CASA program, for example, is a good way to get involved. There's a CASA in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. CASA, I think in almost 1,000 jurisdictions across the country. So this is a very successful program that serves 251,000 children across the country. Mm. And what it does is it links a everyday citizen up with a kid and has that everyday citizen make sure that that kid is represented adequately in the dependency court system, which is the arbiter of their lives. So it's a very important thing. It's a relatively heavy toll in terms of your commitment. You have to give a time commitment. You have to follow that kid the whole way through. So you could be talking years. Another way to, I think I've become very interested, I just did a story about how in Los Angeles County, they're trying to make sure that kids can visit with their biological family members, which is a big part of reunifying. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to use ride-sharing apps like Uber or Hop Skip Drive or one of these other to get those kids to go visit with their families, because all these social workers are spending so much time in their cars driving them. Through that work, I came across a program wherein people can volunteer to monitor the family visitation. And I think that that's kind of like being a CASA, but it's lower burden. So if you could figure out a way to volunteer to monitor family visitation, that's really important to making sure families get back together. So that's another way you could get involved.
Great.
And one last thing is if you really don't want to spend too much time, there's a website called One Simple Wish. And you could go there and then you could, kid wants a bike, you can buy him a bike.
That was Daniel Heimpel, a journalist and lecturer at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy and founder of Fostering Media Connections, a nonprofit focused on solutions-based reporting on the foster care system. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a sound from a Bay Area event with a few simple rules. Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? KALW's Eli Wirtschafter hopped on his bike to bring us this story.
I'm on my bike in West Oakland, and I'm surrounded by a herd of maybe 400 other bicyclists.
All right, we are biking along Mandela Boulevard. Beautiful sunset.
And if you've never conducted an interview while riding a bicycle, it's easier than you might think. Use one hand to hang onto your bike and your other hand to point your microphone at people riding next to you.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Ream. How's it going, Mr. Microphone?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Man, there are like so many bicycles. As far as the eye can see.
It's a mass of Bay Area humanity. People who came intentionally, people who were brought by fate.
I was gonna come, and then I was at work too late, and then this is my commute, and just at that last turn, I was like, why are there so many bicycles? And then I realized that I'm a lucky lady. Whoa, low rider, little wheels, pirate flag. Beautiful things going by.
Bike party!
This is East Bay Bike Party. It started in 2009 as an offshoot of Critical Mass, the group bike ride that blocks traffic in San Francisco. But whereas Critical Mass is part fun, part protest, Bike Party is strictly about the fun. We're not trying to block traffic, but of course cars get stopped and beep their horns at us. Most drivers seem supportive, but you know, it can be kind of hard to tell a supportive honk from an angry honk. Bike Party happens once a month. A group of volunteers plans the route, they post it to Facebook, and literally hundreds of people show up. There's also a monthly theme. On this ride, there's tons of people dressed up as cartoon characters.
I'm wearing a costume that's supposed to be Tinkerbell.
Kathy Cora from Walnut Creek.
It's a green tutu, some green wings, and a necklace of flowers and some sparkly shoes and some obnoxious neon tights.
I'm wearing a brown suede jacket and jeans, sort of radio reporter clothes. I find someone else who isn't doing the costume thing.
My name is Mieko Mihano Gawa Simmons.
Mia is 8 years old, and she's here with her dad.
It's not like usual parties I've been to.
What's different about it?
There's not much kids, and there's like blazing loud music, and I don't know much people. I think it's weird that a couple people are wearing costumes.
Yeah, you didn't want to bring a costume.
Never.
Never?
Ever.
Never?
Ever.
Do you like to wear costumes on Halloween?
Yeah, on Halloween, yeah, but I would never just come here biking wearing a costume.
Bike party is somehow pretty wholesome and wild and crazy all at the same time.
My name is R.B. I'm the president of the original Scraper Bike Team.
Reginald Burnett Jr., better known as R.B., is here with the original Scraper Bike Team, a group of Oakland youth he teaches how to build bikes.
And then we decorate them with fancy and bright flamboyant color tape and spray paint, and then we come out and showcase our bike.
R.B. painted his bike all silver and bright magenta. It's inspired by his favorite cereal, Captain Crunch, Oops All Berries.
And then I painted my wheels with like berry colored paint and I put Oops All Berries.
Oh, and by the way, RB's bike is like 5 feet tall.
So I'm just riding in the air and I feel lovely. I sit up high, I'm visible, I can see everything. And yeah, I'll have fun.
Down here on the ground, I can see a few people hauling big trailers on the back of their bikes.
I'm Joel, I do the recycle bike.
This is Joel Clark. He made this trailer specifically for Bike Party.
It's a regular mountain bike, but on the back there's a trailer full of garbage and recycling.
It's mostly cans and beer bottles, so it's heavy.
Why are you doing this? Because we gotta keep the city clean. You can't just let everyone trash it.
Later, Joel's gonna bring all those bottles and cans to a recycling center for cash. It's the only kind of income Bike Party has. And Joel says that all the money goes right back into building new recycle bikes.
Yeah, the last person interviewed me, we weren't rolling.
We keep on rolling, and soon we reach the first official stop of the night, Aquatic Park on the Berkeley Marina. All the bikes pull over, and suddenly it's just a huge dance party by the side of the bay. If you don't feel like dancing, you can wander around asking people about their costumes.
I'm actually dressed up like a penguin right now, and on my right side I have a unicorn and a dinosaur, Hello Kitty, and a pony as well.
That's what we wear in Switzerland every day.
Are you all from Switzerland?
Yes!
Why aren't you dancing?
Because we're a little bit busy with you now.
We didn't drink enough.
Why aren't you dancing?
I'm working.
If you dance with us, we can dance.
All right, should we go dance?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, let's go. In Berkeley, dancing with a Swiss unicorn, I'm Eli Wirtschafter for Cross Currents.
Dancing with a Swiss unicorn. That really is one of the best sign-offs ever. Okay, our audiograph winner this week is Dan Roisman. Congratulations, Dan. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. And if you got inspired to get out and ride, the next bike party is tomorrow night. You can find all the details at KALW.org. Audiograph's taking a short break during KALW's fall membership campaign, but we'll have great sounds and stories for you when we come back. In the meantime, I'm going to be playing some of my favorite Audiograph sounds and talking about sonic landscapes tomorrow night at the D. Young Museum. Admission's free, so come on out. I'd love to see you there. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And Audiograph listeners, if you have any suggestions on where we should record next, give us a call and tell us about them. 415-264-7106 is the number to call. Again, that's 415-264-7106. Our team today includes Bonnie Chan, Chris Hoff, Jürgen Klemm, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Olivia Henry, Lucy Kang, Justine Lee, Lisa Morehouse, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Ted Muldoon, and the line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by pianist Manny Mocha. Maybe you've heard him on the Jazz After Hours program from PRI. Manny Mocha will be joined by a 9-piece Bay Area ensemble called The Band on Fire. They play Oakland on Saturday night. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.